Hey guys, I'm Adam Rappaport, and this is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. This week, we are talking a kitchen essential, a cooking must-have, salt. And yet, so many people, they kind of either undersalt or oversalt or not sure what kind of salt to use. And, well, we clear it all up for you. We've got food director Carla Lolly Music and senior food director Chris Morocco. Join me to talk about different intensities of saltiness, how to season as you go, taste as you cook, what ingredients impart a salty flavor without being, you know, straight up salt crystals, and more. And then after that, kind of semi-related, Carla and senior food editor Claire Saffitz take you through the step-by-step for a classic salted caramel chocolate tart. If you ever had the original one done by Claudia Fleming, pastry OG at Gramercy Tavern, you will know what I'm talking about. We ran the recipe in our March issue. I would check that out. I would make it. It's delicious. So let's talk salt and more. All right, here is Carla, Chris, and me.
Salt is salty.
Salt everywhere.
Carla.
Yes, sir.
I really like salt.
Yeah, who doesn't? I mean, if you don't like salt, you just don't like life. You don't like flavor. You don't like things tasting good.
You need salt to survive.
I think that you do. You definitely do. But I think we should have a caveat just up front. If you are on a restricted sodium diet, we're very, very, very sorry. We understand it's not your fault. And this podcast is not for you.
Yes.
You're not going to like it.
Can I say this? There was going to be a dot, dot, dot. But I don't like oversalting.
Yeah, that there's a fine line, isn't
there?
It's
the only thing worse than not enough salt.
It's so true. It literally makes things inedible.
Yeah.
It might be worse than undersalt. I don't know what's
worse
to eat.
It's worse.
That's interesting because I think undersalting is offensive because of the blandness, but oversalting, you can still eat boiled potatoes that aren't salted. You're like, eh. These are just not at all satisfying. If something's too salty, you're like, I can't.
You can't eat it.
I can't touch it.
It'll burn your tongue. It's really terrible. It sucks.
Can I just get this out of the way?
Yeah.
It's all stop kvetching after this. My biggest complaint in New York City, you go to the little Frenchy bistros or what Brett Martin calls TGI Vendredi. those are the bistros that look like a bistro, and you get your little steak frite, and there's so much salt on the fries, to the point that it burns your lip, to the point that I now have to order, can I get a steak frite, but can I have these fries unsalted, please? But I'll add the salt myself, and my wife looks at me like I'm a moron.
Wow.
But it's like, no, you're so, why do you, like, the chefs, you've seen, if you ever seen an open kitchen, line cooks, when they take like the little metal bowl and they take the fries fresh out of the fryer and they do that thing where they toss it in the elliptical motion and the amount of salt they pour on there. I'm like, dude, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like, why would you think that anyone needs that much salt on their French fries?
I mean, I think one of the truths about being a line cook is that you become completely, you know, inured to, is that a word?
Inured. Great word. Inured.
Like, I don't usually say it. I usually write it. Well, so you become
inured. Like you stop. It stops.
No, I know what it means. Yeah. I said it wrong. You become desensitized the effect of salt. Your palate's pretty blown out. You're like, you know, you just kind of go to another level. A lot of line cooks smoke and drink. Also, that deadens your taste buds. And I think they're operating under the assumption that most of that salt is bouncing off the perfectly fried exterior of the fry and going
settling
to the bottom of the bowl.
Yep.
So then, and over the course of the night, too, if you come in at the end of the night when all the salt is like all coated up, and yeah, it can be bad.
So we are not medical doctors, so we're not going to speak medically about salt too much, at least, or at least we won't speak knowingly about the effects of salt on the diet. But you guys are professional cooks. You both work in the BA Test Kitchen, worked in restaurants, etc. So can we talk about salting effectively and smartly when it actually comes to cooking? And I guess if you could, Carla, start us off, like, where do you start? Like, what are some key things we should be thinking about as a home cook for what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong?
I think the number one thing that will change the way that your food tastes is understanding salting as you go and seasoning as you go. So unless you're having a one-step, you know, process like a sliced tomato with salt on it, which is a perfectly wonderful thing to eat, and kind of you don't need anything more than that. But anything where you're cooking, where you're starting by sauteing some onions and then you're adding another ingredient, and say it's like you're making sauteed greens, right? So you start with some shallot and some garlic. You want to salt that as it's sweating, and you're seasoning that ingredient. Then you're adding your greens to that, and you want to salt again so that the greens themselves are salted, not expecting that they're going to get all of their seasoning from what you already did in the first step of the recipe. And, you know, then if you added another ingredient to that, say like a drained can of beans, and you're going to toss that through, like you want to salt again, but you can't do it willy-nilly. So salting as you go is also a tasting as you go. I think a lot of people just read recipes and they cook the thing, and then at the end they taste it and try to make up for all of that layered seasoning at the very last step.
And I think
you can't, it's really hard then to completely, I said inure before, to completely imbue an ingredient with seasoning like all the way through by just seasoning at the end.
Yeah, I think the step-by-step process, even if you, we're not saying that the total sum amount of salt you're adding is going to be more, but by doing it step by step in increments, each ingredient is able to absorb the salt and sort of bring out its true flavor.
Right.
And the salt is going to act on each ingredient. Like the salt on those onions that you started with is going to help break those onions down because it's going to want to pull moisture from them.
Yep.
Right. So it's going to do the same thing with those greens.
Yep.
It's not just about adding the flavor, you know, bringing out the flavor, but it's literally acting, you know, in all the kind of miraculous ways that salt does on those ingredients.
Right. I was doing a pasta video the other day. Shout out to Fettuccine Alfredo. And one of the points was like, you take this for granted, but salting the pasta water is the only time that the noodles themselves are being seasoned as they cook. You have to, if you don't salt the water, everybody's had this experience, and it's terrible, of getting to the end and realizing I didn't salt the pasta water. And you just can't make up for it. Putting salt on it, it's not in it.
Raising my hand.
I know.
So we all have spouses.
Yep. We do currently.
Yeah. Yes. For the moment.
I know you've had this before where like we all help each other out in the kitchen and you're like, wait, Simone, I thought you said you salted the pasta water because she's the one who got the water going and then she was going to take a shower and I was going to jump in and she's, I didn't say that. I'm like, yes, you did. And then all of a sudden.
But well, if you tasted your water.
Oh, come on. No one tastes boiling water.
You can also, if you're not sure, you can taste the water. And also you can see if it's been boiling for a bit, there will be that like salt ring.
You can't leave that kind of thing up to anybody else, I find. You know, because when you tell somebody, hey, you know, some friend of mine, can you salt this pasta water for me? You should see the pinch they take.
Yeah. Right.
Like literally a pinch in this like cauldron of water. And you're like,
cauldron. Ooh.
Thanks. And then when their back is turned, they're just like shaking it.
I know. That's my dad in the kitchen with my mom. He's like, salt the... Salt, go add more salt. And I'm like, Frank, chill out.
So let's talk about it. So pasta is a good example of something all of us eat a lot of in some form or another, noodles, pasta, whatever you want to call it. And so if making pasta for four, got a big pot of water going. We're talking, you know, with kosher salt, which is what we like to use here in the test kitchen. Diamond kosher is what we like. I mean, you're talking a healthy handful.
Pasta water, yeah, quarter cup minimum.
Yeah, for four people. You're not talking a pinch, you said, Chris.
Sure,
And again, that's not all going into your diet that you're eating.
Right.
But you need to imbue those noodles that you wanted to absorb the nice saltiness. And then you take it out, and then you're making a sauce.
Right.
Which you're also salting.
Right.
You know, it's
and then there's salty cheese. So there's other forms of salt, too. In Alfredo, actually, I seasoned very lightly in the pan because I used pasta water, which had already been seasoned, unsalted butter, but a lot of Parmesan. And Parm has salt. It's salty. It's a salty cheese. So it's one of those things where the flavor of the Parm, you actually need to be careful. Same with making linguine with clams. The clams themselves have...
Okay. Some can
quite
be really,
really
bright.
Salty, and sometimes I don't have to salt at all. Actually, pretty rarely do I have to salt the linguine with clam sauce itself. The noodles are salted,
But when you've got the clams going in the pan with the white wine and garlic and everything, do you ever go to Esca up on 9th Avenue and 43rd Street? Back in the day when Dave Pasternak, the chef, was doing his linguine, he would get these little cockles or little clams. Mm. They were so salty that the waiter would literally have to issue a warning. It's like, just to let you know, they're very briny. And you're like, oh, how briny could they be? and they'd come and you're like, holy cow.
They're really briny. I mean, that brings up another good point, and it's just good manners. I think when you sit down to eat, and especially if someone else has cooked for you, whether it's a chef or your loving spouse or whoever it is, taste the food before you add salt. That's like, to me.
What do you mean? At the table?
At the table. Yes. Yeah. Like when someone sits down and just automatically like puts a bunch of extra salt and pepper on a dish, it's like, could you taste it first?
Back in the day, Maxine Rappaport, and you know, she came of age in the 50s and 60s and probably had her share of cigarettes and martinis back in the day, but she would just, she'll just reach for the salt shaker.
Right.
It doesn't matter what, if it's a fancy restaurant or whatever. I'm like, Mom, like, why are you, she's like, I know it needs salt. I'm like, okay, she's inured like a line cook.
And it may need it. So I know Chris looked into some more like the nerddom of this, which I'm really excited about, because one of the main questions I have is like, why does salt make food taste better?
Yes.
I mean, it, you know, it has that just sort of like magical ability to bring out the flavors that are there. It's just you, when you taste food that doesn't have any salt in it, and frankly, like many people do, because I think a lot of people don't frankly use enough, it's just flat.
Right.
Yeah. It's not just taste better, it's taste, period.
It's right. Taste, period.
It's taste.
Yeah. You'll taste somebody's food sometimes and you'll think, wow, I taste cumin and I taste coriander and there's kind of all this stuff going on in here, but there is like, it's like kind of like a flat line. There's nothing is bringing that out, you know? And the ability to taste, you know, to salt to taste and bring your food to that point where the salt, you know, is bringing out all that flavor and nuance. I mean, that is like literally the most important thing you can learn as a cook. Like, it's not the pan that you're using. It's not the stove that you're using.
Totally.
Just using salt, you know, enough of it and properly is, you know, I'd say probably 65% of the game.
I think using salt incrementally as you cook, so every element is salted a bit. It doesn't need to be oversalted, obviously. And you talk a lot about tasting, and I'm guilty of that. I think that's something that professional chefs do all the time. You go into a nice professional kitchen, you see that little bin of tasting spoons.
Yeah.
And they're constantly tasting as they go. I think as a home cook, and like I said, I'm guilty of this, we follow a recipe or we follow what we think is our recipe, and we just don't taste.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, why not? I think make that point to taste as you're layering the recipe together.
Yeah, even things that you may not want to taste while they're raw, like a meatloaf or a meatball mixture, just getting in the habit of pinching off a little piece of that mixture before you do the whole batch, put it in a tiny pan and fry it up and make sure it tastes good. Because if you don't and you make a batch of, you know, 48 meatballs and all of them are under seasoned, it sucks.
That's a great point. When I was doing we did a latke podcast back in the wintertime, and Missy Robbins of Lilia Restaurant in Brooklyn came in, and she was smart, and I was not. We had a little competition beforehand on Facebook Live, and she did a little tester latke in oil to taste it to see how it, and I was like, oh, I should have done that.
That's another good example, because eating that raw is going to be a little bit hard to tell.
Whereas back in the day, before people started freaking out about doneness and all of that sort of stuff, before there were warnings on menu about uncooked food, my mom would always give me a pinch of her meatloaf mixture.
I used to uncooked. Eat. Same.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I remember that so clearly, eating when my mom was making, like, just forming
Emma's
burger patties.
Emma over here is making, like, disgusted emoji face right now.
I remember just being so delicious, and then at a certain point, it was like, you just didn't do that, you know? But, like, even my kids want to stick their hands in, well, they both eat raw dough. They're gross. But I did it also with my there's a pancake recipe that I make all the time and I know by heart, and I don't have to look it up, but I just straight up forgot to put the half teaspoon of salt in these pancakes, and they looked great and they were fluffy and they cooked the way they always do, and Cosmo was happy, and I was tasting them and I was like, they're good, and then I realized, like, it's exactly what you're saying. They were just a little flat, and I was like, oh man, I forgot salt. To put salt in these.
Okay, let's talk about some specific cooking tips. I want to run through a few with you guys.
Sure, yeah.
Let's start off with meat, both whether long-cooked meat or quick-cooking meat.
Mm-hmm.
Some thoughts, Carla?
Well, with long-cooked meat, we're usually talking about a very large piece of meat. So whether it's like a big short rib that's very thick, or a roast or a pork shoulder or a brisket, because these pieces of meat are not only going to cook for a long time, but they're huge, salting the surface is like not quite going to cut it. right? So that's why it's large roasts, if ever you can, to give them 24 hours with a really generous coating of salt and pepper, if you like pepper, otherwise just salt. Teaspoon per pound, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, and this helps with your latke kind of conundrum too, of like, or like your meatloaf, just like even establishing a baseline for how much salt to start with. You know, like generally speaking, when, you know, when we season in that those situations, we're talking about a teaspoon of diamond crystal salt per pound.
Okay, so let's talk, like, a 6 pound brisket is often like a size of a brisket you'll get for dinner if you go to a butcher,
right?
6-7 pounds, so you would want 7 teaspoons of kosher salt sprinkled all over it.
Yes,
if you're talking diamond crystal.
Yeah,
diamond
Morton crystal, you want to make that like half, or about half.
And Morton's iodized or Morton
kosher.
Oh, kosher. And iodized, is that's a lot. Iodized,
we're just assuming you threw that away in the 90s.
That is like,
so say I got a pork shoulder, brisket, etc., salting it. Do I need to wrap it in like plastic wrap or anything, or do I just put it in the fridge?
No, you don't have to. It's not going to hurt it if you do, especially if you're going to do a braise, like that you're not worried about like drying out the surface or anything. But that the weight's going to be on the little butcher sticker, right? Yeah. So you don't really have to have a scale or worry about that. So leg of lamb, pork shoulder, big, you know, even like a rib roast or a double thick porterhouse that you're going to roast.
And if you don't have 24 hours, you can just leave it on the counter for an hour, room temp, and let it absorb.
And I think if you didn't, so say you have just a really thick pork chop or two, like double rib pork chops that you're making tonight for dinner, you're going to pan sear them and then you're going to move them into the oven to finish cooking through, and you're not pre-salting or whatever. Start with that, you know, roughly teaspoon per pound or just a very good coating on all sides. Cook it the way you were going to cook it.
Hold on a second.
Oh, yeah.
So you give it the coat, let it sit there for, say, you have half an hour,
hour. Sure, whatever you have.
Before you pan sear it / roast it, you want to pat it dry first, right? Because doesn't it get super wet and all the moisture comes out?
It can. If you're still in that interval where the salt is still drawing liquid from the meat, then you're probably going to want to pat it dry. Eventually, you know, especially like if you leave that it's better, you know, with your double cut, you know, pork chop to leave it uncovered in the fridge, because hopefully you can get past that point where there's sort of surface moisture.
That moisture evaporates.
Where it gets drawn back into the meat, you know, because it's wanting to, the salt is wanting to go from area of high concentration to lower concentration inside the meat.
Science.
So it sort of wants to stabilize and equalize across all of it. But then you'll get actually like a drier surface on the coating of that pork chop, and you'll actually get
if it's the day before, uncovered is a great rule.
I don't have that time.
Right. Okay. So it's Wednesday night. Simone's in the shower. You're like, she's going to be back down here about half an hour.
She's actually more of a bath person.
Okay.
She'll be about an hour.
So it'll be however long.
I like a shower. She likes to have her candle, the bath, the whole thing.
So you've got a TK amount of time while Simone's in the bath.
TK is an editing word for
come.
Yeah.
So, right?
It's a long story.
Anyways. Okay. Anyway, so the first thing you do when you get home, before you even figure out what your side is going to be, you unwrap your double thick pork chop from, I'm talking to Adam, so it's either from Florence or Italy, but on a weeknight it's probably Italy, and salt that.
Wow. The listener cannot see the roll of the eyes from Carla right there. You're Italian. Come on.
I love Italy. I'll swing by there on the way home too. You talk about Italy. You love Italy.
I should get endorsed. Anyway.
You should. Yeah. We all should. Italy, if you're out there. So you salt it, make it rain, all the sides, including the rib side, including the fat side. You're thinking, Simone, how long are you doing? Oh, she's still like barely. The water's not even turned off yet.
She can't even hear me. Do you know what I do? I have to text her to get an answer.
Okay, so...
And can we take a minute to just say, like, we need the salt needs to drop from a high place.
Salt bay.
Like, yeah, exactly. I mean, you don't have to roll it off your elbow, but I mean, points
hurt
for style. Yeah. You know, but it needs to, you need to drop it from higher up so that you get even dispersal.
Yeah.
Right.
You don't want clumps of salt. You want a nice coating.
And I think, you know, people, hopefully we've said it enough so that people, you know, understand by now, but the reason we use diamond crystal is because it's flakier and it, relatively speaking, it's less dense than some of the other salts out there. So you can use more of it, which helps you disperse it.
Yeah.
More evenly.
Right.
It's also one thing I was talking with someone asking about why we like it. It's also what I like about diamond is it holds well between your thumb and your two forefinger and middle finger. You know, you do that little three-finger pinch, and like the crystals like clump
nice
together
tactile
nicely.
Sense, tactile. Yeah.
Tactile, good word. Sorry, but so anyway, so Simone's in the shower.
But to that point, this is a really good point about how to season, distance, height.
Because some people get real close to it and paint, like are they painting it on.
It lands in clumps and it's not spread out. But the other thing that, and this is a point that we made in the salt primer that was two summers ago. It was a while ago, but it's, the internet is knows no time, so you can always find this stuff. It was a really good point that I didn't make, but so smart. The best salt for you to use is the one that you're used to using. So in very large parts of this country, Morton rules, and everybody uses Morton kosher, and chefs use it, and they know it, and they know how much to add, and they know what it feels like when they do the three-finger pinch. And like for them, like switching to Diamond would be, they would be undersalting everything.
Yeah.
So we love Diamond because of the properties that it has. It dissolves more quickly. It's showers more evenly and all that stuff, but it's also the one we use every day, so we just like don't mess around.
Dance with the date who brung you.
Exactly. Okay, so the pork chop has been salted, it's hanging out for however long, then nice cast iron pan, nice glug of olive oil, get a good sear going. Adam has maybe been turned on to the frequent turning method that we've been talking about a bit, whatever. So you get a nice crust, you turn, you thing, you make sure to render the fat side. His oven's already on. He puts that in at 400 and is going to let it cook to the right internal temperature. Everything that has happened is perfect. Resting the pork chop at that point is perfect. But because it didn't have time to hang out and it is a very thick cut of meat, the key thing here is going to be slicing it off of the rib bone, you know, cutting the meat off the bone and then slicing that into nice fat, perfectly pink, juicy pieces. Mm. And then salting. This is another thing you see restaurant chefs do. Salt the inside of those slices.
Yes.
Because the outside is properly seasoned, but you did not get into the middle. And this is like a big problem that we have with like standing rib roast.
Yeah.
Just the middle of that chop is there had no chance. So you either need to sauce it, or put a nicely seasoned salsa verde onto it, or season it with salt, because otherwise it is going to just taste like pork meat.
And this is what we call a finishing salt.
Correct.
And this is where we're big fans of Malden sea salt from England. We also like, I have a big tub of Jacobson sea salt.
We have a big tub of Jacobson too.
out from Oregon, but those big flaky crystals that you sort of sprinkle on, and that when you have a pork chop or like a ribeye or a strip steak, I find that beef sort of desires that finish almost more than pork. But you give it that sprinkle, and not only does it imbue the interior of the meat with a nice salty flavor, you also get that nice crunch.
Right,
which
right.
is really satisfying.
It's true. And it looks cool. They're so awesome looking.
Yeah.
I don't know.
They're
looking
beautiful.
At
they're like
the
snowflakes.
Jacobson, they're crystallized in that, like, it's not a diamond, though, because it's like
pyramid.
It's a pyramid.
So let's talk, and because I don't really care about this because I never cook fish at home, but I know some people do, apparently. let's talk about salting fish compared to salting meat, and you don't salt at the same amount, do you? You're not coating that piece of cod. Like, you're not making it rain all over that, are you?
We do, but we don't let it hang out. We
right.
kind of, you season and go with
right.
fish. It just usually doesn't benefit from having the salt sit on it. Now, some people might do kind of like put fish into a brine,
right.
like an actual liquid salt solution to tighten it.
Who does that?
Chefs
you know,
do it, but not for
they
long.
Do it, but
they'll do it for
not
like
for long,
half an hour.
Just to
I mean,
kind of
is,
firm it up a little bit.
It's a more delicate fin fish and flat fish are very thin.
Yeah,
like
so if you have flounder
fillets,
or something,
like,
or fluke, it's
yeah.
that's like a half an inch.
Yeah, you're not talking about a 2-inch ribeye.
That's
here.
A quick sprinkle.
When I was a line cook, we used two different kinds of salts on the line, and we would always use the La Baleine. I'm mispronouncing it, but it's a fine sea salt, not iodized, and it's very fine and it dissolves quickly, and that was the salt we were supposed to use for seasoning fish, and then we used kosher for meat. Hmm. And for a while I did that at home, and then at a certain point I was like, enough already. So I just use kosher. But like for scallops and stuff, it was always fine salt. Did you ever?
No, never had that.
Never
had that. Yeah. I think it depends. Like there's like a house salt in every restaurant.
Right.
I've seen, you know, the La Baleine, the blue canister, like at Frankie's that got, you know, guys would like be
right.
shaking it right out of the container.
Right.
Like using this little flap as a doser.
Yeah. I think if you've been in a grocery store, you've seen La Baleine. There's there's the blue tube. It almost looks like a Pringles can.
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
there's the red tube,
right.
whether it's coarse or fine.
But if it's not La Baleine, there's other, you know, crisp. If you want, if you prefer a fine salt, if that's what you're used to, just there are plenty of fine sea salts. Just we don't endorse an iodized salt. It's just got a real off flavor.
Are you familiar with the history of iodized salt?
Yes.
Yes.
A little bit.
Chris?
1924. And
wow. Nice.
Boom. So there was a huge issue that people were, you know, basically like having iodine deficiencies.
Right.
And there was like a huge swath of the country where people just weren't getting enough iodine in their diet. So in 1924 or thereabouts,
it was mostly the non-coastal areas.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
The sea water, the sea air would infuse.
Would get into like crops and things, you know,
which had iodine products. Naturally.
Exactly. So they basically just started adding it to table salt as a way of dealing with thyroid deficiencies. So the same thing with like vitamin D and milk, you know, where it's like, you know,
you stop
vitamin D has
outside.
Nothing to do with milk, but
right.
You know what? You know, people were getting rickets all over the place and they just started putting vitamin D in the milk.
People, studies with GIs enlisting in the military, and a lot of guys in the Midwest had goiters.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was a result of iodine deficiency. And they also recorded all these studies that literally IQs rose about 10 to 15 points based on pre and post iodized salt.
Right. So don't, you know, shout out to iodine.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
When it comes to salt, we're like a natural sea salt.
Yeah.
Whether
actually,
it's coarse
I've been
or
feeling
fine.
Less smart than I used to be. It might be because
might
of
be
all
it.
This kosher salt. So you got a lighter hand with the fish, salt, meat, fairly aggressively, but you know, with other vegetables and stuff, season as you go, taste. This has become very trendy over the last 10 years in an outward facing way, but let's talk about salt in dessert.
Yeah, this is a thing. If you have old cookbooks or you have grandma's recipe cards or the, you know, three generations ago joy of cooking, the amount of salt called for in desserts is either not there at all or in very small quantities. So one of the easiest ways to upgrade like a recipe that you inherited is to just right off the bat double the salt. But it just goes back to what Chris was saying, like salt makes tastes taste.
Right.
So
and that includes sweet things.
Yeah.
It includes chocolate, you know, includes like dairy, butter, you know, even like just sweetness. The perception of sweetness is like changed by the presence of salt.
And all you have to think about is like a Reese's peanut butter cup. Like your peanut butter's in my chocolate, your chocolate's in my peanut. That thing is so salty.
Snickers, yeah. Snickers bars.
Very salty. And like a chocolate dipped pretzel stick, like it is fantastic when you get salt and sugar together. Those examples, I think, push it to the extreme. Dream of like it's about that so sweet and so salty, but even you know just the kind of the modern way of sprinkling a coarse finishing salt on your chocolate chip cookie, you could do that with your existing Toll House recipe, whatever you use, just to add that extra, and the salt really brings out the flavor but also the crunch.
Yeah. What about salts that aren't salt in the conventional sense, ingredients that introduce a sodium saltiness to a dish but aren't your typical kosher salt?
I mean, I'm thinking right away of like things like, you know, Parmesan, you
capers.
Know, capers, botarga, you know,
fish sauce,
you know, I mean, and chances are at some point in the process of making that thing, that's why I paused for a sec, salt was used,
right.
You know, I mean, like these are all kind of cured, brined, pickled, you know, products.
Capers are packed in salt, aren't they?
Like, well, they can
Or in a pickling brine,
super,
which is also
super intense
salty.
Brine. Yeah.
Anchovies, olives, you know, canned beans come out of the can really salty.
But, so to your point, Carla, if you're using these ingredients, again, taste as you go because they're going to introduce a salty element to the
dish. And it's also a way to layer saltiness without always relying on salt. So there's, you know, they're more rounded flavors. They're bringing salt. Like think about an anchovy, which we talked about when we recorded our April issue podcast. But, you know, something like an anchovy will bring salt to the equation, but it's also bringing a rounder, like deep umami flavor.
Yeah.
Even something like, you know, nutritional yeast has like a saltiness to it. That's something I really love. Putting salt on top of, you know, salted butter is a salted thing.
But it's interesting. Like, let's take anchovies for an instance, even though I'm not a fan, but putting some anchovy fillets on top of your Caesar salad that's already been tossed and made is one thing that's kind of like a finishing saltiness. Mm-hmm. grinding up some anchovies and putting them in a pasta sauce, that saltiness will imbue that whole sauce
right.
in a way that you don't might not need to salt it as much because exactly. the anchovies is doing that work.
Pickles in your tartar sauce, yeah. you know?
What about, like for instance, Chris, if you're, let's say it's grilling season coming up and you're making a marinade for some chicken skewers, let's say, and the marinade is a soy sauce based marinade. Mm-hmm. If I'm doing that, do I not need to use conventional salt?
You might want to season super lightly, like right before grilling. But honestly, like to Carla's point, like having a little test piece, like in a perfect world would be ideal. But chances are, like, you don't just want the soy sauce, you know, for your marinade. Like, you also would want a little bit of sweetness for balance,
yes.
you know? Anything that's, like, you know, where you're going to add salt. Like, when we think of, like, sort of the pillars of flavor, like, you have, you know, your salt, you know, your seasoning, and then you have fat, you know, and richness. Then you have acid. So sugar, you know, kind of the quiet sort of fourth pillar.
You know, soy is you could think of in the same way as salt. It is, yeah. is the same,
yeah.
you know, in a Korean or a Japanese or Chinese household, like they're not also sprinkling yeah. salt.
I was just going to say shout out to our friend Samin Nosrat, whose book, Salt, Sugar, Fat, yeah. Acid.
Acid, Heat.
I can't remember, yeah. like, wait, what's the order again? But anyways, we had her on a podcast last year and we talked about salt among all these other elements, but those are the elemental pillars of cooking and you want yeah. that balance in there.
Right.
But if you had to eliminate three.
yeah, I'd stick with salt.
Everything but salt. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So you always, you know, you're looking for like a balance of flavor and like soy sauce can bring you a certain amount of the way there, if not all the way. Same thing with fish sauce, you know, like James Seibout,
right.
you know, and those lamb shanks, you know, from like it was Cook Like a Pro or
yeah,
something.
A
like just
years
seasoning
ago.
Lamb shanks exclusively with fish sauce is eminently possible. It's just a matter of like, do you want that? Do you
right.
want all the other flavors that kind of come with that
right.
and the funk?
Yeah. But right. again, like at the end, whether it's, you know, you're grilling boneless chicken thighs this summer with a soy honey marinade or something, then you know you when you get to the table, you might still want to do a little sprinkling of Malden or Jacobson.
Yeah, you might, but you might taste it first.
Yeah, you can do the one, but again, come back to tasting, but again, think about it.
Right,
you know, and I think too often we don't think about it. We just put the food out because we followed the directions.
Right. I mean, there's other things that I do in the summer because salt is such an important ingredient. Like you were saying, like in the way that Gatorade is super salty and sweet, in the summer, drinks that have a little bit of salt in them are just more hydrating. So even when I make
you're trying to say a margarita is hydrating.
No, I was actually, I mean, yes, a margarita, but you know, having a lemonade that you just put a sprinkle of salt into.
Really?
Yeah, it'll blow your mind. Mm. And when I make watermelon juice, just by blending watermelon in the blender and then straining it, I always add lime juice because it's like so sweet. And then I add a pinch of salt and it just makes it better. I put a little bit of salt into the morning smoothies. Like it's just,
Wow, who knew?
Well, that's the thing about like balancing all those sort of like, you know, all those different flavors of salt and sweet and everything is like, once you bring the salt to a certain level, now I want to bring the sweet up a little bit.
Right.
And now, okay, maybe heat kind of comes in.
Right. And then it can take a little more acid.
And then
yeah.
you kind of ratchet up. And that's why you sometimes go to a restaurant and you taste something and your head just literally spins
right off
because
no, I don't think literally.
Well, no,
well,
it does.
Almost literally.
My sister, the first time, my sister had the Pok Pok wings that are fish saucy and soy and sweet and everything. She like, you know, we were eating and it was whatever. And then she kind of pushed back from the table and she was like, too much flavor. it's just too much.
Nina. Well, it's funny that you mentioned with beverages and salt. You're like, why would you ever put salt in beverages? And I just realized now when I go to work out at my gym, I have my post-workout smoothie that I've written about for whatever I've written about for.
It must have been healthy-ish.
My editor or something. Yeah. Editor, I think it was on healthy-ish. And you can find it on bonapetite.com. I don't know what it's called, Rappo Smoothie. But
probably. Chris worked on it. Yeah.
But it's got peanut butter in it.
Right.
And that's what brings me back every time when I'm at the gym, like doing annoying like curls or crunches or whatever those things are called. I literally am thinking about it. And it's got like strawberries and acai, and there's that base note of the salty peanut butter that pulls it all together, and I just am addicted to the thing.
Yeah.
And if it weren't that, it would just be sweet.
Right. Exactly.
Fruity sweet.
And cloying.
Yeah.
So there's another example, and I can't remember what book it's from, but it's like classic American literature, so whatever, I just can't remember. So somebody tell us what I'm thinking of. But there's a scene in this book where the character has a cold bottle of Coca-Cola, like a cold glass bottle, and it's summer. And, oh, wait, no, it's a movie, Sissy Spacek in it. Whoa. Anyway, and she puts salted, roasted.
Is it Coal Miner's Daughter?
Yes, but it's not Coal Miner's Daughter. It's another movie. Anyway, and she's got this cold, freezing cold, like, glass bottle of Coke, and she takes salted, roasted peanuts and pours them into the bottle.
They fizz.
And is drinking that, and the salty and the sweet, and it's just one of those things that, like, you just leave the theater and go home and, like, well, never done this before, but I'm going to do it now. Yeah.
Well, this has been awesome, guys. So you listeners, go buy some kosher salt. Go get some nice finishing salt.
Yeah, it's a little bit like olive oil. You need your everyday and you need your nice one for finishing.
Yeah.
So your salt that you use in the soup and the salt that you put on top.
And don't forget to taste as you go. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Ciao. All right, we're here today to talk about three magical ingredients and the magical union they make when they come together. And I'm talking specifically about chocolate and caramel and salt.
Yeah.
Which, Claire, you brought together in really a magical harmony in our March issue.
Yeah. We did this recipe for a salted, sometimes I have a hard time saying it because it's a lot of words in a row. Salted caramel chocolate tart. There we go. With the chocolate crust.
Salted caramel chocolate tart. That's right.
Yeah. I feel like we have this discussion a lot where we think really carefully about what kinds of desserts we want to include in each issue, because it's not always, I mean, we always want to include a couple of desserts. And this one came about because we figured it's in our March issue, so it's still winter in like most of the country. And this is also a BA's best, so it's a fairly iconic recipe made very popular by the talented pastry chef Claudia Fleming when she was at the pastry chef at Gramercy Tavern in the 90s.
I think one of the reasons that it became such a thing, well, like you were saying, it wasn't necessarily new to combine salted caramel and chocolate.
Right. This is sort of an old French sweet. Yeah, so you see salted caramel, chocolate-covered salted caramels a lot in France, and just salted caramels on their own. Salted caramel is a thing in Brittany where they use a lot of salted butter. So it's essentially you just cook sugar until it melts and turns this toasty caramelly color, and then you add a little bit of cream and some salted butter. In this case, we just add salt on its own and unsalted butter. But so that, yeah, this is a thing that exists, this combination of chocolate, salt, and caramel. But Claudia Fleming was really the person who popularized it in tart form at Gramercy Tavern.
And it sort of became famous there. It was like the dessert that you had to order if you were at Gramercy Tavern. But then she put it in her cookbook,
yes, The Last Course,
which has since gone out of print.
Unfortunately.
So then it becomes one of those, like, you know, days of yore and like what was actually in it and who has a copy of the book. So
right.
When you look for her name and this name of this tart, you'll get a lot of results that are adapted from or modified or attempts at. And from the beginning, we were fairly shameless about the fact that we were also trying to recreate an iconic, legendary tart and combination. So even the chocolate crust, right, was that?
Yes, that's
original?
Part of the original. Yeah. So I do have a copy of The Last Course, which I bought on Amazon. And now they're very expensive because it is out of print.
When did you buy yours? Because I was looking
a couple years ago
researching this. They're hundreds of dollars.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, sorry. Well, I have it at home. I think I paid like 90 bucks, which kind of at the time almost even felt like a deal because I had heard that they go for even more than that. And it is a brilliant book. And there are so many recipes in it. And Claudia Fleming is such an icon of for pastry chefs all over. She really like pioneered this style of desserts that really got away from the more like fine dining, tons of the elements on the plate. Her style was like much more I don't want to say rustic because it was still very refined, but like fewer elements on the plate, and like very fruit forward.
Very modern without being nouveau. Right, you know,
but still like, something really like elemental and familiar about them too. So there's so many iconic recipes of hers in that book. There's like this, her famous buttermilk panna cotta, which is so good. So I have a copy of the book and I was fortunate enough to try, I don't know if it was the original version, but the version of this tart that she's making now, because Claudia Fleming famously moved out to the North Fork of Long Island and opened North Fork Table and Inn with a couple of partners and is still out there cooking. So I had it there. I went a couple summers ago and tried it there. And so she was making it in individual little tartlets with a very, very thin chocolate crust and then filled with a caramel that was really pretty loose, like it sort of, when you spooned into it, it kind of pulled out onto the plate, and then this beautiful dark chocolate topping. So we took that, the spirit of that tart, and made it larger format, easy for entertaining and for a group, and also like made it a little more sliceable.
Right. And in a lot of the BA best recipes that are developed in the test kitchen, we tend to be a little bit more finicky and persnickety about finalizing them and kind of giving the stamp of approval. And just for listeners, so there's a lot of recipes that are developed in the test kitchen that, you know, come up to a tasting. We have these tastings every day at 3 o'clock or other times of day as well. And a lot of dishes that are made by the genius food editors in the test kitchen will be presented to the editors and to me like one time, you know, and we might have it and go like, yeah, it's great. And I don't really have any substantial changes at all. So it could be like a one and done. But with BA's best, because they're, I don't know, they have this sort of special hanger on them that we want people to come back to these and make these over time, and that there are, you know, just, you know, stand as a classic. So the elements never really changed in this tart from the beginning of your development. It was always a chocolate crust. It was always a salted caramel filling that had some give to it. Mm-hmm. And then the ganache topping that also was going to have salt. But just the amount of like little tweaks along the way.
Right.
And I remember you talking about how thin the crust was in the one that you had and how hard that would be to do in a 10-inch.
Right.
When you're rolling out. Why are chocolate crusts more delicate? Like, what is it about this crust that made it just a little bit harder to work with than an ordinary butter crust?
Well, I think with chocolate crusts, you're just adding cocoa. And so you're taking out a little bit of flour because you're adding additional dry ingredients. I suppose that takes out a little bit of gluten. And so it makes the crust a little more delicate. It's not like pie dough, which is very flaky but also coarse with big pieces of butter. This is more like a pâte sucré or like a sweet tart dough. So it does use an egg yolk. And it calls for milk or water if you don't have milk, because it's really annoying to have to go out and buy milk if you're only using 3 tablespoons for a tart crust. But it's just, I think part of what's difficult about it is rolling it out thinly and then lining, like, over such a big area and then lining this tart crust. So there's a really fun trick in this recipe that I actually, like, had a moment of inspiration watching Mary Berry on some... It was like her and Paul Hollywood on some like Christmas special.
It was for the Great British Baking.
It was Great British Baking Show, like Christmas special, where they went back and did like highlights from the season, and then Mary and Paul made their own recipes.
Oh.
And so she was making a tart. This was like 11 o'clock one night. I was watching this at home.
Mary Berry is amazing.
I love watching them together. And they're no, they're kind of mean so to good. Each other. It's kind of funny. So she rolled out this very thin tart dough. And this recipe gets made in a classic tart shell with a fluted edge and a removable bottom.
And is 10 inch?
So we call for a 9 or 10 inch. You can, all the quantities will work in either size. If you use a 10 inch, you'll have a slightly thinner layers of everything.
And I feel like, because I cross tested this recipe, which our listeners might not know, like everything, once it's finalized, someone else in the kitchen makes it from scratch just to, you know, kind of do it clean, straight through, as though we were the reader at home, and you're not really making modifications. And I feel like I did it in the 10 inch because we were double checking that.
Right. And so I did it in a 9.
And you did it in a 9.
Yeah.
So yeah, it worked.
Yeah. so rest assured. But the trick for lining a tart shell without breaking this, you know, thin crust, that, and because it's thin, it warms up quickly. Mm-hmm. And so it gets a little harder to work
with. And it's a short crust, right? Because of the addition of that fat, right? The yolk. Doesn't that make it short?
Yeah, that it does. I mean, yeah, because it adds a little bit of richness. But it's really just like not worked very much.
Right.
So, you know, you don't want to develop gluten. You want it to have like a snap instead of like a chew.
Right.
So you roll it out and you sort of, you know, use a generous amount of flour so that it doesn't stick. And then you lift up the dough. You can use a bench scraper to help you. And you slide the removable bottom of the tart shell quickly, like sort of underneath and into the center of that big round. And then you fold the edges in. Like if you've ever made a galette where you know how to sort of like fold the edges in so that they overlap, you fold the edges in so that the entire crust is sitting like within the perimeter of that removable bottom.
So no dough is hanging over the edge of the little removable bottom,
right.
Which is just a thin disc. Pretty flexible steel,
right,
I guess.
Right. Sometimes aluminum, yeah.
And so you're not trying to fold it into quarters. You're just sort of like flipping the edge of the
right.
big tart circle
right.
inside of the smaller circle of the tart pan.
Right. All that excess overhang, you're just folding toward the center.
Right.
Because you're about to unfold it, so you take the removable bottom, and you set it back inside the edge, like the ring.
The ring.
And then you unfold all those edges, and what you have is like a perfectly slumped, not torn or like stretched dough that's much easier than to like work into not only that right angle where
right.
the base meets the ring,
yeah,
but like to press up against the sides,
right.
And that also helps to reduce shrinking. Like if you kind of pull and tear at the crust as you're trying to get it in the tart shell, it has a greater tendency to shrink.
The dreaded shrinkage.
Yeah, I mean it's hard to get a crust that doesn't shrink at all. This
right.
one shrinks a little bit.
Right.
It's not a big deal. But I also say, and then there's this great move where you take the rolling pin and you
that part.
Yeah, you press down on top of the ring with the overhang, kind of like, you know, going outwards in all directions, and you roll kind of gently, and it pinches off the dough and gives you this nice clean edge.
It's a very Play-Doh moment. And
yes,
so there were two things that when I was cross testing, I was really grateful for that trick of sliding the little tart bottom underneath, because that's always the scariest moment when you've rolled out your dough and it's just on the work surface, and then you have to like pick it up and bring it over and mm-hmm. lower it down. It's like the helicopter drop,
right?
You know,
and it's easier in a pie plate where you have sloped edges,
right.
But in a tart shell where you have right angles and also kind of a sharp
yeah.
edge that can easily kind of snag and tear the dough,
yeah.
this is a much easier way to do
so
it.
So instead of, you know, some recipes say to quarter it and then lift it in and unfold it, and then you can have tears on those creases
mm-hmm.
or roll it onto the pin and then unfurl it.
Mm-hmm.
That I thought was really helpful. So thank you, Mary Berry.
Yeah, thanks.
Great job. Great job, Claire, staying up late, watching TV,
right.
and getting the tips.
Always learning from Mary Berry. And then I also, another good tip is to save. So there is some excess dough, and that's by design, because if you make it in a bigger or smaller tart shell, it's like it's a flexible amount of dough. But save a little bit, because when you bake it, so this in this recipe, you don't bake the crust again after you fill it.
Right.
It gets fully baked to like its crispiness. And that's a little challenging with a chocolate crust because it's not pale,
it's not
so you
easy.
Can't see it darken.
Right. Right.
It's already dark.
So it's not a blind bake. The initial cook time when it goes into the oven with weights on, it has weights on top of
it. First it's weighted.
And you're cooking that, you know, with a normal blind bake for a tart that you're going to return to the oven and bake again, you
mm-hmm.
would leave it kind of pale. But this is
right.
going, like you said, all the way through.
Right. You want it to be dry
right.
and crisp, like, because it's not going to get baked anymore. So one thing is save a little bit of those scraps that you pinch off from the edge, because sometimes these crusts have a tendency to crack a little bit on the bottom, and you don't want there to be any like holes or weak spots, because you know, it has to support that filling.
Yeah, no shrinkage, no leakage.
Right. So save a little bit of that, and so that it goes into the oven for like about 15 minutes with the weights on it. And when you pull those weights off, if you notice any places where maybe some of the crust came off, where from the
right,
parchment
stuck.
Or mm-hmm. Or it's just cracked, you can use a little bit of that dough to patch the little seam right there.
I think I
and
had
then put
to
it back in the
that
oven
too.
Yeah.
And in the thinner parts, sometimes they just like pull apart from each other.
Right.
And then you'll get a little tear, even though it wasn't torn.
Right.
So then you just patch it up.
Mm-hmm. Back in the oven.
I feel like a good visual also is when the dough in the blind bake goes from looking greasy or shiny, which is the, you know, the butter is like melted, to
mm-hmm.
Like you said, it feels dry and it'll look matte.
Right, exactly. So that's a good indicator for when it's finished blind baking. And you'll also smell it because you can't see it turn golden. Like use your nose and eyes. So once it starts to look and feel dry and once it starts to smell done, if it smells like the cocoa is, you know, you can almost smell that like slight bitter scent of something going a little too dark, then time to pull it out of the oven. Yeah. It'll be fine though.
Yeah.
And then you just want to let that cool all the way and then you can prepare your filling.
Okay. So I also like about this because you could make that crust and bake it like a day in advance if you want to just wrap it at that point and break this up into pieces.
Yeah, you could make the dough, freeze it, and let it thaw overnight, and then you can use it. And then you can also bake just the crust on its own. And once it cools, wrap it pretty tightly so that it doesn't pull moisture out of the air and start to soften. And then you can, you know, fill it the next day.
All right, so let's move on to caramel.
Right.
Because this one's pretty classic, except there's a smart addition of cream of tartar.
Yes.
In the sugar mixture that you start with.
Right.
And why did you add it?
Yeah. So this is a wet caramel, meaning you add a little bit of water to the sugar as you're melting it, as opposed to a dry caramel where you're just, it's only sugar. So wet caramel is a little bit easier, especially when you have larger quantities of sugar. This uses a cup and a half of sugar in the filling. So it's quite a lot. It's a little more consistent. Like you get a little more even in terms of like the cooking. You don't get parts that are turning very, very dark and while other parts are still like unmelted or undissolved. And then we add cream of tartar, which is an acid, which helps prevent crystallization because what you don't want is like a grainy, like unpleasant caramel.
That's the worst.
Yeah.
Then when you're like start watching it bubble and then it's like nothing is happening.
Right.
Like the bubbles have that sandy
look
on top of them.
Right.
Our other good friend, Shirley Corher from Cook Science. Is that the name of her book?
Cookwise and Bakewise.
Cookwise and Bakewise, right. And I was reading about caramel one day for something work-related, and it was really interesting. She said that wet caramels actually are more flavorful than dry caramels because they take longer to cook.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are in all of those in-between stages of, you know, taking on caramelization for longer, and it actually, like, deepens and develops the flavor. Even though you might achieve the same color with a dry caramel, the fact that it's cooking in the water makes it taste more.
Oh, I had no idea.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, so interesting.
And now I'm like, because I love making dry caramels for certain things, but after I read that, I was like, well, it does feel a little bit like a shortcut now.
Right. And the water boils off. It's like it's not going to caramelize until all the water is gone.
It's like that time of being, I guess it spends longer times in each temperature phase and that deepens and develops the flavor. It's like slowly building the crust on a steak instead of just like blasting it.
Right.
Anywho, so you've got your water, your sugar, your cream of tartar, and kind of achieving, again, like a deep mahogany.
Yeah. So I love caramel making. I think it can scare people. I mean, you don't want to get any like hot melted sugar on you because that is painful.
My bad burn.
Oh, yeah. But it's really, it shouldn't be such an anxious process. You just want to sit there and be patient and watch it. I have walked away from caramel before, and it goes from beautiful and liquid to like this horrible, it always reminds me, it's like this black, like
lava.
Honeycomby kind of mess. It always reminds me of Maleficent's castle in Sleeping Beauty, like spiky black, like that's what it looks like.
Totally.
But that can happen very quickly. So you just want to stay with it and keep an eye on it.
And that first phase where the water is heating up and the sugar is going from dry to melted into the syrup, that to me, and I've made so many crystallized sugars and so or caramels or failed caramels, that stage I think is really key to not rush.
Like, yes.
Don't keep the heat really, really low until you're confident that all of the sugar crystals are dissolved.
Right.
Because if they're not and you start boiling, then those are the crystals that are going to like attract all the other crystals.
Right. They set off a chain reaction and then you have graininess. So that's true. I mean, usually you hear people say like never stir caramel. But in the beginning, you can stir because you want to encourage the sugar to dissolve first. And then you can bring it to a boil. And once it's at a boil and you can see that it's free
and it's
of
clear,
granules.
It'll go from cloudy to clear.
Right. Then stop stirring. And at that point, we only swirl. And you can have an extra layer of insurance if you keep a pastry brush and a little water next to you in a little bowl. And as you see crystals start to form around the edge of the pot, Just brush it down with a little bit of water and they'll kind of dissolve and join back in with all the other sugar.
Yeah.
And so that's, I mean,
it really with cream of tartar,
it's, you're not at so much of a risk, but if you've had issues with caramel making in the past and you just want some extra assurance, then you can certainly do that too. And at that point, it's just about kind of swirling it occasionally and watching it take on color slowly. And if this is a time where you really want to use like your best pot with a heavy bottom, because that prevents hot spots. So sometimes the problem is you have is that one side of the pot is clear and then the other side is getting like really, really dark and starting to smoke. So that's why you swirl it often to equalize the heat. And you'll also start to notice, you'll be like, nothing's happening. It's been 8 minutes. Like, what's taking so long? It's never going to happen.
Yeah.
It'll happen, and it happens pretty fast.
Right.
So you'll notice that the bubbles at first are popping really quickly and it's boiling pretty vigorously. And then as time goes on, even though it's still clear, the bubbles will start to get bigger and pop more slowly.
And then
you're getting close.
The syrup is heavier.
Right. There's less water.
Right. And it's one of those arcs in the temperature where it rises really, really, really slowly for a long time. And then when it hits, I don't know what temperature exactly it is, but when it achieves a certain temperature, then it spikes.
Right.
So that's what to be on the alert for. And it's one of those, I really love it too. And I love watching the color change and sort of being there. So you just need to be in the zone and you need to like just watch what's happening.
Yeah. Don't get distracted.
No, be super observant. Get your Rachel Maddow on.
Right. And also, and have your, have your butter and cream at the ready, because you want to take caramel pretty, like you want to push it to the limit where you're seeing some really dark spots form and it's smelling, it, as you said, like looks super dark amber, even mahogany. But
so
it doesn't smell acrid
that?
Yet.
Why do you want to take it so far? Because I feel like people think of the color of caramel as, you know, what you get in those little like square chews, you know, that caramel is some like a beige.
Right. I mean, there's a time for a blonder caramel, but I don't think this is that case because, you know, it's a cup and a half of sugar in the filling. And if you don't cook the caramel dark to the point where you get all these really interesting, like bittersweet notes, then I just think the whole dessert's going to be way too sweet.
Got it.
So, you know, it's a lot of sugar and like, you know, caramel is the main ingredient, but we really want to avoid that overly sweet, like saccharine, toothachey kind of flavor.
And so the dark color is actually that the caramelization, a little bit of the burnt caramel flavor.
A little bit. Yeah. You don't want it to taste unpleasantly bitter, but you want that kind of super complex bitter sweetness in the filling. And also the salt that you add at the end will also like highlight a lot of those flavors. So the darkness is really an indication of sort of flavor.
Got it. Okay.
Flavor
so
development.
You're in your heaviest pan and it should have high sides too to add. To,
yeah.
Like a heavy bottom pan that also has some height on the side.
Yeah.
Because in the next step you get this like very vigorous bubbling. So you're super dark.
And then you want to stop cooking because there's so much heat in that caramel, it will continue to darken if you just took it off the heat and set it aside. That's happened to me before. So you immediately want to add your other ingredients because that will cause the temperature to drop and so it will stop cooking. So those ingredients are butter and heavy cream. And then of course salt.
Right.
So what happens if you put something cold in caramel? Sometimes it'll seize up. So it'll go from liquid and it'll harden again because you've made the temperature drop really fast. So if your heavy cream is cold, although in the recipe we don't specify room temperature, but that's okay. Just put it back over low heat and keep stirring until it smooths out.
Yeah.
And this caramel, because we wanted the tart to be sliceable, so you get that nice sort of point when you cut a slice, it's a pretty thick caramel. Like we don't add a lot of, so adding these a liquid ingredient like heavy cream is what makes caramel chewy.
Yeah, this was one of those moments where I was like, Claire's going to kill me. Right. I think we did three versions where it was like, I don't remember. Where did we end up? It was a quarter cup? It was like a third of a cup?
A third. I think the first time I tried it, I did a half cup of cream and we decided, I mean, the flavor, it was never really about the flavor. It was just like, oh, it was a construction issue. It was like, it's a little too oozy.
Because adding that butter fat and the liquid in the cream at the end to the caramel is what makes it actually pourable. Because if you took just the sugar mixture to that dark and poured it out, it would harden to like a brittle.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would be rock hard like glass.
Right.
So the adding the cream and the butter is what gives it its viscosity. It also gives it delicious flavor. I mean, it's adding like the sweetness and the richness and whatever, but that was, we sort of like, we were going for the bulge, right? So you wanted to like cut into a slice, and you have the chocolate tart crust on the bottom. You have this like beautiful caramel in the middle, and then on top, we haven't even gotten there, but there's a ganache topping. Mm-hmm. And looking for the thing where you slice it and the caramel in the middle like muffin tops over the, the bottom, but doesn't quite like spill over,
right?
Which was different than the consistency in the little individual one that you had.
Yeah, it was kind of a Goldilocks moment where it was like it had to be firm enough to slice, but not so firm that it was also going to stick in your teeth when you ate it. Like it had to sort of melt.
I'm still chewing. Right, like, it's too hard.
Right, and so we started. I think at a half a cup of cream was too much. A quarter cup of cream was too little.
It was too tacky.
And so we split the difference at a third of a cup and decided that that was the right amount. A great thing about this recipe is there's these three main components, and they're all really easy to kind of make individually and then assemble for whenever you want to serve it. So you can make that caramel and let it cool and store it in an airtight container and chill it until it's ready to use. And then all you need to do is rewarm it so that you can pour it back into the baked tart shell.
Right.
And also there's a lot of salt. There's a teaspoon of, we used Diamond Kosher in the test kitchen. Which has a different saltiness by weight to Morton's. So if you're wary of making something too salty, you just start with maybe a half teaspoon and keep adding.
I cross-tested it with the Morton's and it was, we decided it was fine. But one of the things that I noticed was the salt, because Morton is a coarser, bigger crystal. They dissolve more slowly. So I noticed that once I added it to the caramel, it actually kind of sunk to the bottom of the measuring cup, mm-hmm. and there was like a bunch of salt at the bottom. So if you are using Morton, just be aware of that and make sure to stir it really well to make sure that all of those salt crystals are dispersed through the whole caramel mixture.
Right, and it eventually dissolved,
Dissolved, yeah. But it was something that when you're cross-testing, you want to kind of like notice all these things that could be potential pitfalls for somebody at home, because if you're pouring it out and then you get to the bottom of the measuring cup and it's like...
all the salt is down
this,
there.
This like salty sludge, you know, that's going to end up in like one spot. So the caramel itself will be under-seasoned and then you'll have like a salt lick on top. So if you use Morton, just make sure it's, stir it well and make sure it's dissolved.
Right. So that gets poured into the crust, and it has to be a little bit warm because if it's room temperature, it will set up. So you want it to kind of spread it, be warm enough so that it oozes into and fills the shape of the tart shell. And we get like a lot of air bubbles when that happens, which are fine because you're going to cover it up anyway. And another thing we discussed while making this tart that was also just sort of more about like structure than flavor was like, what do we want it to look like? Do we want it to have this like smooth mirror finish with the ganache, or like kind of swirly texture? And we went back and forth, and ultimately at the end we decided we liked the idea of kind of spreading a slightly cooled ganache over so you get texture rather than, because the Claudie Fleming's version is just
wall to wall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just perfect.
Right. And for
surface.
Us, you know, when we're developing these recipes, I say we, Claire was developing it and I was like giving my.
We were workshopping.
Solicited and occasionally unsolicited opinions. But one of the nice things about the ganache, thinking about how this was going to photograph in the magazine, was that if we took the photo of the finished tart from above, and the ganache went all the way to the edge of the crust, looking at it, it's just going to look like a chocolate tart. So the advantage of having that frosting-ish texture of the ganache was that we could leave a little bit of a border so that when you look at the tart, you see that there's caramel underneath.
Right.
It's like why in Snickers commercials, they always show it like cut open so you can see what's going on inside.
Right.
And so that was another consideration that was an advantage of having this kind of like bullseye effect.
Right.
Yeah.
And the ganache is probably the easiest component. It's really just ganache is sort of by definition is equal weights of chocolate and cream. It's such a sort of a foundational like thing in all of pastry.
Yeah.
Usually you just pour hot sort of just simmering cream over chocolate that's been chopped up, and you let the chocolate slowly and gently melt, or sorry, you let the cream slowly and gently melt the chocolate, and then you whisk until it's smooth. And at that state, it's pretty liquid, and then you can use it and use it as like a glaze, or you can let it cool slightly, in which case, you know, the chocolate is starting to come back down to room temperature and harden, so it becomes more spreadable. I've learned this lesson before, and I had to learn it again this time, was that you can't use like a super high percentage chocolate yeah. for ganache, because right. the ganache will break.
Right.
It'll break into...
It's all greasy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That happened a couple times, actually.
Yeah.
yeah. So I would go 68% or below for yeah. this one.
Didn't we also change it so that you cook them together?
Did we do it over double boiler?
I think so.
I think we did because
it seized on me.
Right.
And we just... Like, we knew why it was happening, but just, again, for, like, safety's sake. And mm-hmm. one of the, you know, chocolate's expensive, and we hate it when people have bad experiences and then
right.
tell us that their tart
you
was
have
ruined.
To throw it out.
This is the worst.
Right. Right. So this is a very gentle way of heating yeah. it together. Because I have had it happen to me where I've poured cream that was, like, had just boiled and was really, really hot
yeah.
over dark chocolate. And the heat from the cream split, you know, the chocolate separates into its, like, cocoa butter and solids. And it's such a bummer.
We went through a family crisis in my family, because we've been making the same marble cake with a fudge frosting out of Fanny Farmer's baking book since I was little. My mom's been making this marble cake. And when she started using Ronnybrook cream,
oh.
which is like a very high butterfat, non-homogenized heavy cream that is here in New York State, this ganache frosting that she'd been making forever was breaking and splitting. And
too
it took
fat.
Us a really long time to figure it out. But like over the years, she started using better and better chocolate
right.
And better cream. And then she was like, actually, no, you need the ultra pasteurized, homogenized, like regular cream.
Right.
And that was what in the end solved.
Right.
It was the
right.
crisis of like 96, 97, 98. It was
right.
bad.
Well, it's a good example of how we can try as hard as we can to account for all variables when developing a recipe, but there's always going to be like that type of thing where it's like people in this part of the country
yep.
use this kind of product and it just doesn't
it's
it
just not
doesn't
the same.
Work.
Yeah.
We can't anticipate. Right. So please okay. be kind is what we're saying.
So your ganache topping is on.
Mm-hmm.
It's swooped and swirled. That picture, there's this one picture that I'm looking at where you can see the crust and you can see the caramel and like the ganache is mid swooshing
yeah.
over the top,
yeah.
which is really fun.
Yeah.
And it was hard to stop doing that. It was very mesmerizing.
Yes. Yeah.
To, like,
you kind of get in
the
zone.
Perfect. And then the very last thing is more salt.
More salt, yeah. So, but right before you put the chocolate on, make sure the caramel is pretty well set, like it's room temperature, because some heat from, even a little bit of heat from a slightly warm ganache will want to soften that caramel and kind
and
of
vice
and make
versa.
It cool
if
a little bit.
If the caramel is warm, it'll melt the chocolate.
Yeah, it'll back. Make it harder. Right, exactly. They'll start to almost like mingle and then you won't get these nice defined layers. So a little bit of patience is needed. And then once you've made your beautiful swooshes and swirls, and we just use the back of a spoon to do that. Yeah, so a little more flaky salt on top.
A little.
Or a lot. We use Malden.
And why switch to a flaky salt for the topping? Like you've gotten you have your kosher salt and these other elements.
Mm-hmm.
So what was it like, why in this iconic recipe did you feel like it had to be flaky?
Yeah, well, a couple of reasons. I like seeing it, first of all. Like, it doesn't disappear, it doesn't dissolve at all into the chocolate. It sits on top, especially if the ganache is like almost set, then it really just kind of perches right on top like a sprinkle or something, and you can see it, so you know, oh, you have this
right,
you know, this salted topping,
right.
And also I like that crunch that you get with those. Malden is like a sea salt that forms these like pyramid shaped crystals. And I love that crunch that you get when you like get a little piece of it. And also has sort of a nice like minerally flavor. Like
right.
it's not a harsh.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in this dessert because there's bitter notes from the chocolate that is cooked and from the caramel that's taken very dark. And of course there's sweetness in the sugar and the caramel itself and the
mm-hmm.
ganache is sweet. So you have your sweet, you have your salt, and there's bitter notes as well. There's a little bit of acidity in chocolate.
And caramel's acidic.
Mm-hmm. So it's really all of the primary four flavors, salt, sour, salty.
Yeah.
Salt, sour, bitter, sweet.
Yeah.
And so it's really, it is a sweet dessert, but there's like a lot going
yeah,
on.
Yeah, it's really not as sweet as you would think looking at it.
And then you have these textures from the snappiness of the crust and the oozy firmness of that caramel. And then you have like the other sort of more butter whip texture of the ganache and the crunchy salt.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Do we have one? What's happening? Like,
it's really intense.
A hard time. It is.
Eating it. So we say that this in a 9 or 10 inch tart makes 8 servings. You could probably get away with 12 because it's just so, as you say, it has so much going on.
Yeah.
And it's so intense.
Yeah.
That like I have no problem eating full pieces of basically anything, but it's sort of like you have to push yourself a little bit to get through a whole, like, you know, 1 inch slice.
As Aunt Jeanette would say, just a little sliver.
Right. Right. In this case, yes.
Yeah. Great. I forgot how great this was. I just got reconvinced. This is like the best dinner party dessert too.
Yeah. Also very portable.
Very portable.
You can chill
Our own Emma brought it somewhere.
Oh, way to go, Emma.
Yeah. She did the whole thing. She spaced it out. She did components. All right. Well, thanks for coming in talking about salted caramel chocolate tart.
All right. Anytime, Carla.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.